This is Audible.
Recorded Books and One Click Digital present SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome, by Mary Beard. Narrated by Phyllida Nash.
Prologue. The History of Rome. Ancient Rome is important. To ignore the Romans is not just to turn a blind eye to the distant past. Rome still helps to define the way we understand our world and think about ourselves, from high theory to low comedy. After 2,000 years, it continues to underpin Western culture and politics, what we write, and how we see the world and our place in it. The assassination of Julius Caesar on what the Romans called the Ides of March, 44 BCE, has provided the template and the sometimes awkward justification for the killing of tyrants ever since. The layout of the Roman imperial territory underlies the political geography of modern Europe and beyond. The main reason that London is the capital of the United Kingdom is that the Romans made it the capital of their province Britannia, a dangerous place lying, as they saw it, beyond the great ocean that encircled the civilized world. Rome has bequeathed to us ideas of liberty and citizenship, as much as of imperial exploitation, combined with a vocabulary of modern politics, from senators to dictators. It has loaned us its catchphrases, from fearing Greeks bearing gifts, to bread and circuses, and fiddling while Rome burns. Even where there's life, there's hope. And it has prompted laughter, awe, and horror in more or less equal measure. Gladiators are as big box office now as they ever were. Virgil's great epic poem on the foundation of Rome, the Aeneid, almost certainly found more readers in the 20th century CE than it did in the 1st century CE. Yet the history of ancient Rome has changed dramatically over the past 50 years, and even more so over the almost 250 years since Edward Gibbon wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, his idiosyncratic historical experiment that began the modern study of Roman history in the English-speaking world. That is partly because of the new ways of looking at the old evidence and the different questions we choose to put to it. It is a dangerous myth that we are better historians than our predecessors. We are not. But we come to Roman history with different priorities, from gender identity to food supply, that make the ancient past speak to us in a new idiom. There has also been an extraordinary array of new discoveries, in the ground, underwater, even lost in libraries, presenting novelties from antiquity that tell us more about ancient Rome than any modern historian could ever have known before. We now have a manuscript of a touching essay by a Roman doctor whose prized possessions had just gone up in flames, which resurfaced in a Greek monastery only in 2005. We have wrecks of Mediterranean cargo ships that never made it to Rome, with their foreign sculpture, furniture and glass destined for the houses of the rich, and the wine and olive oil that were the staples of everyone. As I write, archaeological scientists are carefully examining samples drilled from the ice cap of Greenland to find the traces, even there, of the pollution produced by Roman industry. Others are putting under the microscope the human excrement found in a cesspit in Herculaneum in southern Italy to itemise the diet of ordinary Romans as it went into and out of their digestive tracts. A lot of eggs and sea urchins are part of the answer. Roman history is always being rewritten, and always has been. In some ways, we know more about ancient Rome than the Romans themselves did. Roman history, in other words, is a work in progress. This book is my contribution to that bigger project. It offers my version of why it matters. SPQR takes its title from another famous Roman catchphrase, Senatus populusque Romanus, the Senate and people of Rome. It is driven by a personal curiosity about Roman history, By a conviction that a dialogue with ancient Rome is still well worth having, and by the question of how a tiny and very unremarkable little village in central Italy became so dominant a power over so much territory in three continents. This is a book about how Rome grew and sustained its position for so long, not about how it declined and fell, if indeed it ever did, in the sense that Gibbon imagined. There are many ways that histories of Rome might construct a fitting conclusion. Some have chosen the conversion of the emperor Constantine to Christianity on his deathbed in 337 CE, or the sack of the city in 410 CE by Alaric and his Visigoths. Mine ends with a culminating moment in 212 CE, when the emperor Caracalla took the step of making every single free inhabitant of the Roman Empire a full Roman citizen, eroding the difference between conqueror and conquered, and completing a process of expanding the rights and privileges of Roman citizenship that had started almost 1,000 years earlier. SPQR is not, however, a simple work of admiration. There is much in the classical world, both Roman and Greek, to engage our interest and demand our attention. Our world would be immeasurably the poorer if we did not continue to interact with theirs. But admiration is a different thing. Happily, a child of my times, I bridle when I hear people talking of great Roman conquerors, or even of Rome's great empire. I have tried to learn to see things from the other side, too. In fact, SPQR confronts some of the myths and half-truths about Rome with which I, like many, grew up. The Romans did not start out with a grand plan of world conquest. Although eventually they did parade their empire in terms of some manifest destiny, the motivations that originally lay behind their military expansion through the Mediterranean world and beyond are still one of history's great puzzles. In acquiring their empire, the Romans did not brutally trample over innocent peoples who were minding their own business in peaceable harmony until the legions appeared on the horizon. Roman victory was undoubtedly vicious. Julius Caesar's conquest of Gaul has not unfairly been compared to genocide and was criticized by Romans at the time in those terms. But Rome expanded into a world not of communities living at peace with one another, but of endemic violence, rival power bases backed up by military force. There was not really any alternative backing, and mini-empires. Most of Rome's enemies were as militaristic as the Romans, but for reasons I shall try to explain, they did not win. Rome was not simply the thuggish younger sibling of classical Greece, committed to engineering, military efficiency, and absolutism, whereas the Greeks preferred intellectual inquiry, theatre, and democracy. It suited some Romans to pretend that was the case, and it has suited many modern historians to present the classical world in terms of a simple dichotomy between the two very different cultures. That is, as we shall see, misleading on both sides. The Greek city-states were as keen on winning battles as the Romans were, and most had little to do with the brief Athenian democratic experiment. Far from being unthinking advocates of imperial might, several Roman writers were the most powerful critics of imperialism there have ever been. "They create desolation and call it peace," is a slogan that has often summed up the consequences of military conquest. It was written in the 2nd century CE by the Roman historian Tacitus, referring to Roman power in Britain. The history of Rome is a big challenge. There is no single story of Rome, especially when the Roman world had expanded far outside Italy. The history of Rome is not the same as the history of Roman Britain or of Roman Africa. Most of my focus will be on the city of Rome and on Roman Italy, but I shall take care also to look in at Rome from the outside, from the point of view of those living in the wider territories of the empire, as soldiers, rebels, or ambitious collaborators. And very different kinds of history have to be written for different periods. For the earliest history of Rome, and when it was expanding in the 4th century BCE, from small village to major player in the Italian peninsula, there are no accounts written by contemporary Romans at all. The story has to be a bold work of reconstruction, which must squeeze individual pieces of evidence, a single fragment of pottery or a few letters inscribed on stone, as hard as it can. Only 3 centuries later, the problem is quite the reverse. How to make sense of the masses of competing contemporary evidence that may threaten to swamp any clear narrative? Roman history also demands a particular sort of imagination. In some ways, to explore ancient Rome from the 21st century is rather like walking on a tightrope, a very careful balancing act. If you look down on one side, everything seems reassuringly familiar. There are conversations going on that we almost join, about the nature of freedom or problems of sex. There are buildings and monuments we recognise, and family life lived out in ways we understand with all their troublesome adolescence. And there are jokes that we get. On the other side, it seems completely alien territory. That means not just the slavery, the filth. There was hardly any such thing as refuse collection in ancient Rome. The human slaughter in the arena, and the death from illnesses, whose cure we now take for granted. But also the newborn babies thrown away on rubbish heaps, the child brides, and the flamboyant eunuch priests. This is a world we will begin to explore through one particular moment of Roman history, which the Romans never ceased to puzzle over, and which modern writers, from historians to dramatists, have never ceased to debate. It offers the best introduction to some of the key characters of ancient Rome, to the richness of Romans' discussion of their own past, and to the ways in which we continue to recapture and try to make sense of it. And to why the history of Rome, its Senate, and its people still matter. Chapter 1. Cicero's Finest Hour. SPQR 63 BCE. Our history of ancient Rome begins in the middle of the 1st century BCE, more than 600 years after the city was founded. It begins with promises of revolution, with a terrorist conspiracy to destroy the city, with undercover operations and public harangues, with a battle fought between Romans and Romans, and with citizens, innocent or not, rounded up and summarily executed in the interests of homeland security. The year is 63 BCE. On the one side is Lucius Sergius Catilina, Catiline in English, a disgruntled, bankrupt aristocrat and the architect of a plot, so it was believed, to assassinate Rome's elected officials and burn the place down, writing off all debts of rich and poor alike in the process. On the other side is Marcus Tullius Cicero, just Cicero from now on, the famous orator, philosopher, priest, poet, politician, wit and raconteur, one of those marked out for assassination, and a man who never ceased to use his rhetorical talents to boast how he had uncovered Catiline's terrible plot and saved the state. This was his finest hour. In 63 BCE, the city of Rome was a vast metropolis of more than 1 million inhabitants, larger than any other in Europe before the 19th century, and, although as yet it had no emperors, it ruled over an empire stretching from Spain to Syria, from the south of France to the Sahara. It was a sprawling mixture of luxury and filth, liberty and exploitation, civic pride and murderous civil war. In the chapters that follow, we shall look much further back, to the very start of Roman time, and to the early exploits, belligerent and otherwise, of the Roman people. We shall think about what lies behind some of those stories of early Rome that still strike a chord today, from Romulus and Remus to the rape of Lucretia. And we shall be asking questions that historians have asked since antiquity itself. How and why did an ordinary little town in central Italy grow so much bigger than any other city in the ancient Mediterranean and come to control such a huge empire? What, if anything, was special about the Romans? But with the history of Rome, it makes little sense to begin the story at the very beginning. It is only in the 1st century BCE that we can start to explore Rome close up and in vivid detail through contemporary eyes. An extraordinary wealth of words survives from this period, from private letters to public speeches, from philosophy to poetry, epic and erotic, scholarly and straight from the street. Thanks to all this, we can still follow the day-to-day wheeling and dealing of Rome's political grandees. We can eavesdrop on their bargaining and their trade-offs and glimpse their backstabbing, metaphorical and literal. We can even get a taste of their private lives, their marital tiffs, their cash flow problems, their grief at the death of beloved children, or occasionally of their beloved slaves. There is no earlier period in the history of the West that it is possible to get to know quite so well or so intimately. We have nothing like such rich and varied evidence from classical Athens. It is not for more than a millennium in the world of Renaissance Florence that we find any other place that we can know in such detail again. What is more, it was during the 1st century BCE that Roman writers themselves began systematically to study the earlier centuries of their city and their empire. Curiosity about Rome's past certainly goes back further than that. We can still read, for example, an analysis of the city's rise to power written by a Greek resident in the mid-2nd century BCE. But it is only from the 1st century BCE that Roman scholars and critics began to pose many of the historical questions that we still pose even now. By a process that combined learned research with a good deal of constructive invention, they pieced together a version of early Rome that we still rely on today. We still see Roman history, at least in part, through 1st century BCE eyes. Or, to put it another way, Roman history, as we know it, started here. 63 BCE is a significant year in that crucial century. It was a time of near disaster for the city. Over the 1,000 years that we will be exploring in this book, Rome faced danger and defeat many times. Around 390 BCE, for example, a posse of marauding Gauls occupied the city. In 218 BC, the Carthaginian warlord, Hannibal, famously crossed the Alps with his 37 elephants and inflicted terrible losses on the Romans before they eventually managed to fight him off. Roman estimates of casualties at the Battle of Cannae in 1216 BCE, up to 70,000 deaths in a single afternoon, make it as great a bloodbath as Gettysburg or the first day of the Somme, maybe even greater. And almost equally fearsome in the Roman imagination, in the 70s BCE, a scratch force of ex-gladiators and runaways under the command of Spartacus proved more than a match for some ill-trained legions. The Romans were never as invincible in battle as we tend to assume, or as they like to make out. In 63 BCE, however, they faced the enemy within, a terrorist plot at the heart of the Roman establishment. The story of this crisis can still be traced in intimate detail, day by day, occasionally hour by hour. We know precisely where much of it happened, and in a few places we can still look up to some of exactly the same monuments as dominated the scene in 63 BCE. We can follow the sting operations that gave Cicero his information on the plot, and see how Catiline was forced out of the city to his makeshift army north of Rome, and into a battle with the official Roman legions that cost him his life. We can also glimpse some of the arguments, controversies, and wider questions that the crisis raised, and still does. The tough response by Cicero, including those summary executions, presented in stark form issues that trouble us even today. Is it legitimate to eliminate terrorists outside the due processes of law? How far should civil rights be sacrificed in the interests of homeland security? The Romans never ceased to debate the conspiracy of Catiline, as it came to be known. Was Catiline wholly evil, or was there something to be said in mitigation of what he did? At what price was revolution averted? The events of 63 BCE and the catchphrases created then have continued to resonate throughout Western history. Some of the exact words spoken in the tense debates that followed the discovery of the plot still find their place in our own political rhetoric, and are still, as we shall see, paraded on the placards and banners, and even in the tweets of modern political protest. Whatever its rights and wrongs, the conspiracy takes us to the centre of Roman political life in the 1st century BCE, to its conventions, controversies, and conflicts. In doing so, it allows us to glimpse in action the Senate and the Roman people, the two institutions whose names are embedded in my title, SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romanus. Individually, and sometimes in bitter opposition, these were the main sources of political authority in 1st century BCE Rome. Together they formed a shorthand slogan for the legitimate power of the Roman state, a slogan that lasted throughout Roman history and continues to be used in Italy in the 21st century CE. More widely still, the Senate, minus the Populusque Romanus, has lent its name to modern legislative assemblies the world over, from the USA to Rwanda. The cast of characters in the crisis includes some of the most famous figures in Roman history. Gaius Julius Caesar, then in his 30s, made a radical contribution to the debate on how to punish the conspirators. Marcus Licinius Crassus, the Roman plutocrat, who notoriously remarked that you could count no one rich if he did not have the cash to raise his own private army, played some mysterious part behind the scenes. But centre stage, as Catiline's main adversary, we find the one person whom it is possible to get to know better than anyone else in the whole of the ancient world. Cicero's speeches, essays, letters, jokes and poetry still fill dozens of volumes of modern printed text. There is no one else in antiquity until Augustine, Christian saint, prolific theologian and avid self-scrutinizer, 450 years later, whose life is documented in public and private fully enough to be able to reconstruct a plausible biography in modern terms. And it is largely through Cicero's writing, his eyes and his prejudices that we see the Roman world of the 1st century BCE and much of the city's history up to his day. The year 63 BCE was the turning point of his career, for things were never quite so good for Cicero again. His career ended 20 years later in failure. Still confident of his own importance, occasionally a name to conjure with, but no longer in the front rank, he was murdered in the civil wars that followed the assassination of Julius Caesar in 44 BCE, his head and right hand pinned up in the centre of Rome for all to see, and to mangle and maim. Cicero's grisly death presaged a yet bigger revolution in the 1st century BCE, which began with a form of popular political power, even if not a democracy exactly, and ended with an autocrat established on the throne and the Roman Empire under one-man rule. Though Cicero may have saved the state in 63 BCE, the truth is that the state, in the form he knew, was not to last much longer. There was another revolution on the horizon, which would be more successful than Catiline's. To the Senate and Roman people was soon added the overweening figure of the Emperor, embodied in a series of autocrats who were part of Western history, flattered and abused, obeyed and ignored for centuries. But that is a story for later in SPQR. For now, we shall put down our feet in one of the most memorable, meatiest and most revealing moments in the whole of Roman history. Cicero versus Catiline. The conflict between Cicero and Catiline was partly a clash of political ideology and ambition, but it was also a clash between men of very different backgrounds. Both of them stood at or very near the top of Roman politics. But that is where the similarity ends. In fact, their contrasting careers offer a vivid illustration of just how varied political life in Rome of the first century BCE could be. Catiline, the would-be revolutionary, had the more conventional, more privileged and apparently safer start in life, as in politics. He came from a distinguished old family that traced its lineage back centuries to the mythical founding fathers of Rome. His ancestor, Segestus, was said to have fled from the east to Italy with Aeneas after the Trojan War, before the city of Rome even existed. Among his blue-blooded forebears, his great-grandfather was a hero of the war against Hannibal, with the extra claim to fame of being the first man known to have entered combat with a prosthetic hand, probably just a metal hook that replaced his right hand, lost in an earlier battle. Catiline himself had a successful early career and was elected to a series of junior political offices, but in 63 BCE, he was close to bankruptcy. A string of crimes was attached to his name, from the murder of his first wife and his own son to sex with a virgin priestess. But whatever his expensive vices, his financial problems came partly from his repeated attempts to secure election as one of the two consuls, the most powerful political posts in the city. Electioneering at Rome could be a costly business. By the first century BCE, it required the kind of lavish generosity that is not always easy to distinguish from bribery. The stakes were high. The men who were successful in the elections had the chance to recoup their outlay, legally or illegally, with some of the perks of office. The failures, and like military defeats, there were many more of those in Rome than is usually acknowledged, fell ever more deeply into debt. That was Catiline's position after he had been beaten in the annual elections for the consulship in both 64 and 63 BCE. Although the usual story is that he had been leaning in that direction before, he now had little option but to resort to revolution or direct action or terrorism, whichever you choose to call it. Joining forces with other upper-class desperados in similar straits, he appealed to the support of the discontented poor within the city, while mustering his makeshift army outside it. And there was no end to his rash promises of debt relief, one of the most despicable forms of radicalism in the eyes of the Roman landed classes, or to his bold threats to take out the leading politicians and to put the whole city to flames. Also Cicero, who was one of those who believed he had been earmarked for destruction, summed up his adversary's motives and aims. He was of a very different stock from Catiline. He came from a wealthy landed background, as all high-level Roman politicians did. But his origins lay outside the capital, in the small town of Arpinum, about 70 miles from Rome, or at least a day's journey at the ancient speed of travel. Though they must have been major players locally, no one in his family before him had ever been prominent on the Roman political scene. With none of Catiline's advantages, Cicero relied on his native talents, on the high-level connections he assiduously cultivated, and on speaking his way to the top. That is to say, his main claim to fame was as a star advocate in the Roman courts. And the celebrity status and prominent supporters that this gave him meant that he was easily elected to each of the required series of junior offices in turn, just like Catiline. But in 64 BCE, where Catiline failed, Cicero succeeded in winning the race for the next year's consulship. That crowning success had not been an entirely foregone conclusion. For all his celebrity, Cicero faced the disadvantage of being a new man, as the Romans called those without political ancestry, and at one stage he even seems to have considered making an electoral pact with Catiline, seedy reputation or not. But in the end, the influential voters swayed it. The Roman electoral system openly and unashamedly gave extra weight to the votes of the rich, and many of them must have concluded that Cicero was a better option than Catiline, whatever their snobbish disdain for his newness. Some of his rivals called him just a lodger at Rome, a part-time citizen. But he topped the poll. Catiline ended up in the unsuccessful third place. In second place, elected as the other consul, was Gaius Antonius Hybrida, uncle of a more famous Antonius, Mark Antony, whose reputation turned out to be not much better than Catiline's. By the summer of 63 BCE, Cicero appears to have got wind of definite danger from Catiline, who was trying his luck as a candidate again. Using his authority as consul, Cicero postponed the next round of elections, and when he finally did let them go ahead, he turned up at the poll with an armed guard and wearing a military breastplate, clearly visible under his toga. It was a histrionic display, and the combination of civilian and military kit was alarmingly incongruous, rather as if a modern politician were to enter the legislature in a business suit with a machine gun slung over his shoulder. But it worked. These scare tactics, combined with Catiline's vociferously populist programme, made sure that he was once more defeated. Claiming that he was down and out, standing up for the other down and outs, could hardly have endeared him to elite voters. Soon after the elections, sometime in the early autumn, Cicero began to receive much clearer intelligence of a violent plot. For a long time he had been getting trickles of information through the girlfriend of one of Catiline's accomplices, a woman named Fulvia, who had more or less turned double agent. Now, thanks to a further piece of treachery from the other side, and via the wealthy Marcus Crassus as intermediary, he had a bundle of letters in his hands that directly incriminated Catiline and referred to the terrible bloodshed that was planned. Information soon supplemented by definite reports of armed forces gathering north of the city in support of the insurrection. Finally, after he dodged an assassination attempt planned for the 7th of November, thanks to a tip-off from Fulvia, Cicero summoned the Senate to meet the next day so that he could formally denounce Catiline and frighten him out of Rome. The senators had already, in October, issued a decree urging or allowing Cicero as consul to make sure that the state should come to no harm, roughly the ancient equivalent of a modern Emergency Powers or Prevention of Terrorism Act, and no less controversial. Now, on the 8th of November, they listened while Cicero went through the whole case against Catiline in a blistering and well-informed attack. It was a marvellous mixture of fury, indignation, self-criticism, and apparently solid fact. One minute he was reminding the assembled company of Catiline's notorious past, the next he was disingenuously regretting that he himself had not reacted to the danger speedily enough. The next he was pouring out precise details of the plot, in whose house the conspirators had gathered, on what dates, who was involved, and what exactly their plans were. Catiline had turned up to face the denunciation in person. He asked the senators not to believe everything they were told and made some jibes about Cicero's modest background, compared with his own distinguished ancestors and their splendid achievements. But he must have realized that his position was hopeless. Overnight, he left town. In the Senate. This encounter in front of the Senate between Cicero and Catiline is the defining moment of the whole story. The two adversaries coming face to face in an institution that lay at the centre of Roman politics. But how should we picture it? The most famous modern attempt to bring before our eyes what happened on that 8th of November is a painting by the 19th century Italian artist Cesare Macari. It is an image that fits comfortably with many of our preconceptions of ancient Rome and its public life. Grand, spacious, formal and elegant. It is also an image with which Cicero would no doubt have been delighted. Catiline sits isolated, head bowed, as if no one wants to risk getting anywhere near him, still less talk to him. Cicero, meanwhile, is the star of the scene, standing next to what seems to be a smoking brazier in front of an altar, addressing the attentive audience of toga-clad senators. Everyday Roman clothing, tunics, cloaks, and even occasionally trousers, was much more varied and colourful than this. Togas, however, were the formal national dress. Romans could define themselves as the gens togata, the race that wears the toga, while some contemporary outsiders occasionally laughed at this strange, cumbersome garment. And togas were white, with the addition of a purple border for anyone who held public office. In fact, the modern word candidate derives from the Latin candidatus, which means whitened, and refers to the specially whitened togas that Romans wore during election campaigns to impress the voters. In a world where status needed to be on show, the niceties of dress went even further. There was also a broad purple stripe on senators' tunics, worn beneath the toga, and a slightly narrower one if you were the next rank down in Roman society, an equestrian or knight, and special shoes for both ranks. Macari has captured the senator's smart togas, even though he seems to have forgotten those significant borders. But in almost every other way, the painting is no more than a seductive fantasy of the occasion and the setting. For a start, Cicero is presented as a white-haired elder statesman, Catiline as a moody young villain, when actually both were in their 40s, and Catiline was the elder by a couple of years. Besides, this is far too sparsely attended a meeting. Unless we are to imagine more of them somewhere off stage, there are barely 50 senators listening to the momentous speech. In the middle of the 1st century BCE, the Senate was a body of some 600 members. They were all men who had been previously elected to political office, and I mean all men. No woman ever held political office in ancient Rome. Anyone who held the junior position of quaestor, 20 of them elected each year, went automatically into the Senate with a seat for life. They met regularly, debating, advising the consuls, and issuing decrees, which were in practice usually obeyed, though, as these did not have the force of law, there was always the awkward question of what would happen if a decree of the Senate was flouted or simply ignored. No doubt attendance fluctuated, but this particular meeting must surely have been packed. As for the setting, it looks Roman enough, but with that huge column stretching up out of sight and the lavish, brightly coloured marble lining the walls, it is far too grand for almost anything in Rome in this period. Our modern image of the ancient city as an extravaganza of gleaming marble on a vast scale is not entirely wrong. But that is a later development in the history of Rome, beginning with the advent of one-man rule under the emperors and with the first systematic exploitation of the marble quarries in Carrara in northern Italy, more than 30 years after the crisis of Catiline. The Rome of Cicero's day, with its million or so inhabitants, was still built largely of brick or local stone, a warren of winding streets and dark alleys. A visitor from Athens or Alexandria in Egypt, which did have many buildings in the style of Macari's painting, would have found the place unimpressive, not to say squalid. It was such a breeding ground of disease that a later Roman doctor wrote that you didn't need to read textbooks to research malaria. It was all around you in the city of Rome. The rented market in slums provided grim accommodation for the poor, but lucrative profits for the unscrupulous landlords. Cicero himself had large amounts of money invested in low-grade property, and once joked, more out of superiority than embarrassment, that even the rats had packed up and left one of his crumbling rental blocks. A few of the richest Romans had begun to raise the eyebrows of onlookers, with their plush private houses fitted out with elaborate paintings, elegant Greek statues, fancy furniture. One-legged tables were a particular cause of envy and anxiety. Even imported marble columns. There was also a scatter of public buildings designed on a grand scale, built in or veneered with marble, offering a glimpse of the lavish face of the city that was to come. But the location of the meeting on the 8th of November was nothing like that. Cicero had summoned the senators to meet, as they often did, in a temple. On this occasion, a modest old building dedicated to the god Jupiter near the Forum at the heart of the city, constructed on the standard rectangular plan, not the semicircular structure of Macari's fantasy. Probably small and ill-lit, with lamps and torches only partly compensating for a lack of windows. We have to imagine several hundred senators packed into a stuffy, cramped space, some sitting on makeshift chairs or benches, others standing and jostling, no doubt, under some venerable ancient statue of Jupiter. It was certainly a momentous occasion in Roman history, but equally certainly, as with many things in Rome, much less elegant in reality than we like to imagine. Triumph and humiliation. The scene that followed has not been recreated by admiring painters. Catiline left town to join his supporters who had scratched together an army outside Rome. Meanwhile, Cicero mounted a clever sting operation to expose the conspirators still left in the city. Ill-advisedly, as it turns out, they had tried to involve in the plot a deputation of men from Gaul who had come to Rome to complain about their exploitation at the hands of Roman provincial governors. For whatever reason, maybe nothing more profound than an instinct for backing the winner, these Gauls decided to work secretly with Cicero, and they were able to provide clinching evidence of names, places, plans, and some more letters with incriminating information. Arrests followed, as well as the usual unconvincing excuses. When the house of one of the conspirators was found stuffed with weapons, the man protested his innocence by claiming that his hobby was weapon collecting. On the 5th of December, Cicero summoned the Senate again to discuss what should be done with the men now in custody. This time the senators met in the temple of the goddess Concord, or Harmony, a sure sign that affairs of state were anything but harmonious. Julius Caesar made the daring suggestion that the captured conspirators should be imprisoned, either, according to one account, until they could be properly tried once the crisis was over, or, according to another, for life. Custodial sentences were not the penalties of choice in the ancient world, prisons being little more than places where criminals were held before execution. Fines, exile, and death made up the usual repertoire of Roman punishment. If Caesar really did advocate life imprisonment in 63 BCE, then it was probably the first time in Western history that this was mooted as an alternative to the death penalty, without success. Relying on the emergency powers decree and on the vociferous support of many senators, Cicero had the men summarily executed, with not even a show trial. Triumphantly, he announced their deaths to the cheering crowd in a famous one-word euphemism. Vix aerae, they have lived, that is, they're dead. Within a few weeks, Roman legions defeated Catiline's army of discontents in North Italy. Catiline himself fell fighting bravely at the front of his men. The Roman commander, Cicero's fellow consul Antonius Hybrida, claimed to have bad feet on the day of the final battle and handed over leadership to his number two, raising suspicions in some quarters about exactly where his sympathies lay. And he was not the only one whose motives were questioned. There have been all sorts of possibly wild, certainly inconclusive speculation going back to the ancient world about which far more successful men might secretly have been backing Catiline. Was he really the agent of the devious Marcus Crassus? And what was Caesar's true position? Catiline's defeat was nonetheless a notable victory for Cicero, and his supporters dubbed him Pater Patriae, or Father of the Fatherland. One of the most splendid and satisfying titles you could have in a highly patriarchal society such as Rome. But his success soon turned sour. Already, on his last day as consul, two of his political rivals prevented him from giving the usual valedictory address to a meeting of the Roman people. "Those who have punished others without a hearing," they insisted, "ought not to have the right to be heard themselves." A few years later, in 58 BCE, the Roman people voted in general terms to expel anyone who had put a citizen to death without trial. Cicero left Rome just before another bill was passed, specifically singling him out by name for exile. So far in this story, the populus, quae Romanus, the PQR in SPQR, has not played a particularly prominent role. The people was a much larger and amorphous body than the Senate, made up, in political terms, of all male Roman citizens. The women had no formal political rights. In 63 BCE, that was around 1 million men spread across the capital and throughout Italy, as well as a few beyond. In practice, it usually comprised the few thousand or the few hundred who, on any particular occasion, chose to turn up to elections, votes, or meetings in the city of Rome. Exactly how influential the people were, as always, even in the ancient world, been one of the big controversies in Roman history. But two things are certain. At this period, they alone could elect the political officials of the Roman state. No matter how blue-blooded you were, you could only hold office as, say, consul, if the Roman people elected you. And they alone, unlike the Senate, could make law. In 58 BCE, Cicero's enemies argued that whatever authority he had claimed under the Senate's Prevention of Terrorism decree, his executions of Catiline's followers had flouted the fundamental right of any Roman citizen to a proper trial. It was up to the people to exile him. The sometime Father of the Fatherland spent a miserable year in North Greece. His abject self-pity is not endearing, until the people voted to recall him. He was welcomed back to the cheers of his supporters, but his house in the city had been demolished and, as if to drive the political point home, a shrine to liberty had been erected on its site. His career never fully recovered. Writing it up. The reasons why we can tell this story in such detail are very simple. The Romans themselves wrote a great deal about it, and a lot of what they wrote has survived. Modern historians often lament how little we can know about some aspects of the ancient world. "Just think of what we don't know about the lives of the poor," they complain, "or of the perspectives of women." This is as anachronistic as it is deceptive. The writers of Roman literature were almost exclusively male, or at least very few works by women have come down to us. The autobiography of the Emperor Nero's mother, Agrippina, must count as one of the saddest losses of classical literature. These men were also almost exclusively well off, even though some Roman poets did like to pretend, as poets still occasionally do, that they were starving in garrets. The complaints, however, miss a far more important point. The single most extraordinary fact about the Roman world is that so much of what the Romans wrote has survived over 2 millennia. We have their poetry, letters, essays, speeches and histories, to which I have already referred, but also novels, geographies, satires and reams of technical writing on everything from water engineering to medicine and disease. The survival is largely due to the diligence of medieval monks, who transcribed by hand, again and again, what they believed were the most important or useful works of classical literature, with a significant but often forgotten contribution from medieval Islamic scholars, who translated into Arabic some of the philosophy and scientific material. And thanks to archaeologists who have excavated papyri from the sands and the rubbish dumps of Egypt, wooden writing tablets from Roman military bases in the north of England, and eloquent tombstones from all over the empire, we have glimpses of the life and letters of some rather more ordinary inhabitants of the Roman world. We have notes sent home, shopping lists, account books, and last messages inscribed on graves. Even if this is a small proportion of what once existed, we have access to more Roman literature and more Roman writing in general than any one person could now thoroughly master in the course of a lifetime. So how is it exactly that we know of the conflict between Catiline and Cicero? The story has come down to us by various routes, and it is partly the variety that makes it so rich. There are brief accounts in the works of a number of ancient Roman historians, including an ancient biography of Cicero himself, all written 100 years or more after the events. More important and more revealing is a long essay stretching over some 50 pages of a standard English translation, which offers a detailed narrative and analysis of the war against Catiline, or Bellum Catilini, to use what was almost certainly its ancient title. It was written only 20 years after the war, in the 40s BCE, by Gaius Sallustius Crispus, or Sallust, as he is now usually known. A new man like Cicero, and a friend and ally of Julius Caesar, he had a very mixed political reputation. His period as a Roman governor in North Africa was infamous, even by Roman standards, for corruption and extortion. But despite his not entirely savoury career, or maybe because of it, Sallust's essay is one of the sharpest pieces of political analysis to survive from the ancient world. Sallust did not simply tell the unfolding story of the attempted uprising, its causes and its upshot. He used the figure of Catiline as an emblem of the wider failings of 1st century BCE Rome. In Sallust's view, the moral fibre of Roman culture had been destroyed by the city's success and by the wealth, greed and lust for power that had followed its conquest of the Mediterranean and the crushing of all its serious rivals. The crucial moment came 83 years before the war against Catiline, when, in 146 BCE, Roman armies finally destroyed Carthage, Hannibal's home base on the north coast of Africa. After that, Sallust thought, no significant threats to Roman domination were left. Catiline may have had positive qualities, as Sallust accepted, from bravery in the front line of battle to extraordinary powers of endurance. His ability to withstand hunger, cold, or sleep deprivation was incredible. But he symbolised much of what was wrong with the Rome of his day. Behind Sallust's essay lie other vivid documents, which ultimately go back to the hand of Cicero himself and give his version of what happened. Some of the letters he wrote to his closest friend, Titus Pomponius Atticus, a wealthy man who never entered formal politics, but often pulled the strings from the sidelines, mention his initially friendly relations with Catiline. mixed with domestic news about the birth of his son. Let me tell you, I have become a father. And the arrival of new statues from Greece to decorate his house. Cicero explains in 65 BCE that he was contemplating defending Catiline in the courts, in the hope that they might later work together. How such private letters ended up in the public domain is something of a mystery. Most likely, a member of Cicero's household made copies of them available after his death, and they quickly circulated among curious readers, fans, and enemies. Nothing was ever published in quite our sense in the ancient world. Almost 1,000 letters in all survive, written both to and by the great man over the last 20 years or so of his life. Revealing his self-pity in exile, all I can do is weep, and his anguish on the death of his daughter after childbirth, while covering topics from thieving agents through society divorces to the ambitions of Julius Caesar, they are some of the most intriguing documents we have from ancient Rome. Equally intriguing as survival, and perhaps even more surprising, is part of a long poem that Cicero wrote to celebrate the achievements of his consulship. It is no longer complete, but it was famous or infamous enough that more than 70 lines of it are quoted by other ancient writers and by Cicero himself in later works. It includes one of the most notorious lines of Latin doggerel to have made it through the Dark Ages. O fortunatam natam me consul Romam, a jingle with something of the ring of Rome was sure a lucky state born in my great consulate, and in what has been seen as a major, if slightly hilarious, lapse of modesty, it seems to have featured an assembly of the gods, in which our superhuman consul discusses, with the divine senate on Mount Olympus, how he should handle Catiline's plot. By the 1st century BCE, reputation and fame in Rome depended not just on word of mouth, but also on publicity, sometimes elaborately, even awkwardly orchestrated. We know that Cicero tried to persuade one of his historian friends, Lucius Lucceius, to write a celebratory account of his defeat of Catiline and its sequel. I am extremely keen, he said in a letter, that my name should be put in the limelight in your writing. And he also hoped that a fashionable Greek poet, whose tricky immigration case he had defended in the Roman courts, would compose a worthy epic on this same subject. In the event, he had to write his own verse tribute to himself. A few modern critics have tried, not very convincingly, to defend the literary quality of the work, and even of what has become its signature line, O fortunatam natam. Most Roman critics, whose views on the topic survive, satirized both the vanity of the enterprise and its language. Even one of Cicero's greatest admirers, a keen student of his oratorical techniques, regretted that he had gone quite so over the top. Others gleefully ridiculed or parodied the poem. But the most direct access that we have to the events of 63 BCE comes from the scripts of some of the speeches that Cicero gave at the time of the uprising. Two were delivered to public meetings of the Roman people, updating them on the progress of the investigations into Catiline's conspiracy and announcing victory over the dissidents. One was Cicero's contribution to the debate in the Senate on the 5th of December, which determined the appropriate penalty for those under arrest. And, most famous of all, there was the speech that he gave to the Senate on the 8th of November, denouncing Catiline, in the words we should imagine coming out of his mouth in Macari's painting. Cicero himself probably circulated copies of all these soon after they had been delivered, laboriously transcribed by a small army of slaves. And, unlike his efforts at poetry, they quickly became admired and much-quoted classics of Latin literature, and prime examples of great oratory to be learned and imitated by Roman schoolboys and would-be public speakers for the rest of antiquity. They were even read and studied by those who were not entirely fluent in Latin. That was certainly going on in Roman Egypt 400 years later. The earliest copies of these speeches to survive have been found on papyrus dating to the 4th or 5th century CE, now just small scraps of what were originally much longer texts. They include the original Latin and a word-for-word translation into Greek. We must imagine a native Greek speaker in Egypt struggling a little and needing some help in getting to grips with Cicero's original language. Many later learners have struggled too. This group of four speeches against Catiline, in Catilinum, or the Catilinarians, as they are now often known, went on to enter the educational and cultural traditions of the West. Copied and disseminated via the medieval monasteries, they were used to drill generations of pupils in the Latin language, and they were closely analysed as literary masterpieces by Renaissance intellectuals and rhetorical theorists. Even today, in mechanically printed editions, they keep their place in the syllabus for those who learn Latin, and they remain models of persuasive oratory whose techniques underlie some of the most famous modern speeches, including those of Tony Blair and Barack Obama. It did not take long for the opening words of Cicero's speech given on the 8th of November, the first Catilinarian, to become one of the best-known and instantly recognisable quotes of the Roman world. Quo usque tandem abutere, Catilina, patientia nostra. How long, Catiline, will you go on abusing our patience? And it was closely followed a few lines later in the written text by the snappy and still much repeated slogan, O tempora, o mores. Oh, what a world we live in, or literally, oh, the times, oh, the customs. In fact, the phrase quo usque tandem must already have been firmly embedded in the Roman literary consciousness by the time that Sallust was writing his account of the war, just 20 years later. So firmly embedded was it that, in pointed out or playful irony, Sallust could put into Catiline's mouth, Quae quo usque tandem patiamine o fortissimi viri, how long will you go on putting up with this, my braves, is how Sallust's revolutionary stirs up his followers, reminding them of the injustices they were suffering at the hands of the elite. The words are purely imaginary. Ancient writers regularly scripted speeches for their protagonists, much as historians today like to ascribe feelings or motives to their characters. The joke here is that Catiline, Cicero's great enemy, is made to voice his antagonist's most famous slogan. That is only one of the wry ironies and pointed paradoxical misquotations in the history of this distinctive phrase. It often lurked in Roman literature whenever revolutionary designs were at stake. Just a few years after Sallust, Titus Livius, or Livy as he is better known, was writing his own history of Rome from its beginning, originally in 142 books. A vast project, even though an ancient book amounted to what fitted onto a roll of papyrus, and is closer to the length of a modern chapter. What Livy had to say about Catiline has been lost. But when he wanted to capture the civil conflicts of hundreds of years earlier, in particular the conspiracy of one Marcus Manlius, who in the 4th century BCE was supposed to have incited the Roman poor to rebellion against the oppressive rule of the elite, he went back to a version of the classic words, Quo usque tandem ignorabitis viris vestras? How long will you go on being ignorant of your strength? He imagined Manlius asking his followers to get them to realise that poor though they were, they had the manpower to succeed. The point here is not merely about an echo of language, nor is it just about the figure of Catiline as a byword for villainy, though he certainly plays that part often enough in Roman literature. His name came to be used as a nickname for unpopular emperors. And half a century later, Publius Virgilius Maro, or Virgil, as he is now usually known, gave him a cameo role in the Aeneid, where the villain is pictured being tortured in the underworld, trembling at the face of the Furies. More important is the way that the conflict between Catiline and Cicero became a powerful template for understanding civil disobedience and insurrection throughout Roman history and beyond. When Roman historians wrote about revolution, the image of Catiline almost always lay somewhere behind their accounts, even at the cost of some strange inversions of chronology. As his carefully chosen words hint, Livy's Marcus Manlius, a nobleman turning to doomed revolution, supported by an impoverished rabble, was largely a projection of Catiline back into early Roman history. The other side of the story. Might there not be another side to the story? The detailed evidence we have from Cicero's pen, or point of view, means that his perspective will always be dominant. But it does not necessarily mean that it is true in any simple sense, or that it is the only way of seeing things. People have wondered for centuries quite how loaded an account Cicero offers us, and have detected alternative views and interpretations just beneath the surface of his version of events. Sallust himself hints as much, for although his account is heavily based on Cicero's writing, by transferring the famous quo usque tandem from the mouth of Cicero to that of Catiline, he may well have been reminding his readers that the facts and their interpretations were, at the very least, fluid. One obvious question is whether the speech we know as the first Catiline Arian really is what Cicero said to the assembled senators in the Temple of Jupiter on the 8th of November. It is hard to imagine that it was a complete fabrication. How would he have got away with circulating a version that bore no relationship to what he had said? But almost certainly it is not a word-for-word match. If he spoke from notes and the ancient equivalent of bullet points, then the text we have presumably lies somewhere between what he remembered saying and what he would have liked to have said. Even if he was reading from a fairly complete text, when he circulated the speech to friends, associates, and those he wanted to impress, he would almost certainly have improved it somewhat, tidying up the loose ends and inserting a few more clever one-liners, which might have been missed out or slipped his mind on the day. A lot hangs, too, on exactly when it was circulated and why. We know from one of his letters to Atticus that Cicero was arranging for the first Catiline Arian to be copied in June 60 BCE, when he must have been well aware that the controversy over his execution of the conspirators was not likely to go away. It would have been tempting and convenient for Cicero to use the written text of the speech in his own defence, even if that meant some strategic adjustments and insertions. In fact, the repeated references in the version we have to Catiline as if he were a foreign enemy, in Latin, hostis, may well be one of the ways in which Cicero responded to his opponents. By referring to the conspirators as enemies of the state, he was implying that they did not deserve the protection of Roman law. They had lost their civic rights, including the right to trial. Of course, that may already have been a leitmotif in the oral version of the speech given on the 8th of November. We simply do not know. But the term certainly took on far greater significance, and I strongly suspect was given far greater emphasis, in the permanent written version. These questions prompt us to look harder for different versions of the story. Never mind Cicero's perspective, is it possible to get any idea of how Catiline and his supporters would have seen it? The words and views of Cicero now dominate the contemporary evidence for the mid-first century BCE. But it is always worth trying to read his version or any version of Roman history against the grain, to prise apart the small chinks in the story using the snatches of other independent evidence that we have, and to ask if other observers might have seen things differently. Were those whom Cicero described as monstrous villains